This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Democratic State Representative Chris Dano of Trempealeau was first elected to the Wisconsin legislature in the fall of 2008. He's now seeking his fourth term representing Western Wisconsin's 92nd State Assembly District. The former Onalaska police officer is facing a challenge from Elmwood business owner and military veteran Isaac Wicks, who's been a candidate for seats in state government in the past. That includes a run as a Democrat for Wisconsin Lieutenant Governor in a recall election 2 years ago and for three other seats in the Wisconsin legislature since 2006. Wisconsin's 92nd State Assembly District covers all or part of Buffalo, Trempealeau, and Jackson counties. Some of the communities where voters live include Alma, Whitehall, Arcadia, and Black River Falls. Dano and Wicks participated in a broadcast forum recorded earlier this week in Wisconsin Public Radio's Eau Claire studios. It included audience questions, but please note, because this was recorded earlier this week, no new calls can be accepted. The forum's moderator is WPR reporter Rich Kramer.
Joining me by phone from his home in Trempealeau, I'd like to welcome Chris Dano. Chris is the Democratic incumbent. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rich.
Next, joining us by phone from his office in Elmwood is Republican challenger Isaac Wicks. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
First off, very basically, I'll start with Isaac Wicks. Just a general why you kind of a question. So, Isaac, why you for the 92nd?
Why me? There you go. Instantly, you're going to have background noise here. I'm actually calling you from the hardware store here, and if you hear background noise, it's either street traffic or customer noise. I apologize for that.
No problem.
Why me? One of the things that we've got going on here in the state of Wisconsin here, and it's played out in the last 4 years, is there's, you know, a lot of animosity between the public and private sector, if you will. You know, that played out in the recalls, and it's played out, been playing out, you know, ever since. You know, the thing is I guess why me? You know, I've got experience in both. I mean, I've been in the Marine Corps for the last 21 years, and I know what it's like to be on the receiving end of political, be the receiving end of a political fights and being the pawn, being moved around. And mm-hmm. I also know, being a small business owner and an employer, I know what it's like to be, asked for more blood every time somebody wants something. So I guess the thing is it's a balance that I'm looking at here. And basically, the thing is, we need to have a little bit more respect for both sides instead of just being, one side or the other type thing.
Gotcha. Quick follow-up. Do you live in the district currently?
Yes, I do. Elmwood confuses everybody. Elmwood is where the hardware store is.
Yeah.
And everybody, you know, if you listen to the radio, I've got radio ads. I'm always, referred to as being from Elmwood, or people associate with me with Elmwood because
sure.
That's where my hardware store is in. And the campaign address, you know, I've got a P.O. box here in Elmwood for the campaign address, but
mm-hmm.
That's just for sake of ease. I mean, I'm, at the hardware store more than at any other place. So that, and it's during the daytime I can, get mail and all that kind of stuff, use the post office, things like that.
Okay.
During the daytime, because this is where I'm at during the daytime. But currently, I live south of Mondovi.
Gotcha. Thanks for that. And Chris Dano, why run for a this would be what, the third term?
This will be like going into it'll be my fourth term.
I'm in my
third term right now.
Okay. So why take another swipe at it?
Well, a couple of reasons. And the first one I'm going to mention, and I'm going to quite frankly take issue with Mr. Wicks's previous statement.
Okay.
I actually live in the district. I've lived in this district for a long time now. If you look at Mr. Wicks, his last voting address was actually in Menominee, which is two districts away. So in the spring elections in April, he voted in Menominee. We checked on that. His official address is a bed and breakfast, which I think tells you something, too. He can claim to live in Mondovi, but we know he really doesn't. And it's unfortunately not an uncommon thing. You can claim a residence wherever you like and claim to really live there, but that's the big thing for me. I ran for this office first time a few years ago because I really wanted to represent this area. I was concerned about the future of rural Wisconsin, and quite frankly, I still am. Now, we are luckier than most rural parts of the state in the sense that our economy is probably doing a lot better than others. But what really inspired me to run was the first time, I'm a big hunter and fisherman, and I travel out west a lot, and I hunt in the Dakotas and western Minnesota. Mm-hmm. And I saw what happened to a lot of the small communities out there, really as they sort of dried up and blew away with the changes in demography and everything like that. And I started seeing some of those same trend lines going on in Wisconsin. And I talked to locals, and I said, what really happened? Well, you know, things changed, and then, you know, people started moving out. Farms got bigger, less people. But the real thing they talked about was when they had trouble with their rural schools. And once the schools closed down, the community started to die because there was no future. And that was really one of my biggest concerns, is that we have a lot of rural schools here. And we were in a position where we've been cutting funding for them. The state aid formula has been horribly detrimental to rural schools. And that was really the big reason I run. I said, I want to see rural Wisconsin be a strong, vibrant, great place to live. And we're lucky. Most of the communities I live in are very vibrant because we do the kinds of things that we need to do to invest and make them. The community I live in, Trempealeau, we've got a beautiful public library. We've got a public swimming. We've got a public pool. We have a nice infrastructure with Perot State Park and the bike trails. And we've also got a great school district. And I want to make sure those things continue to be strong in rural Wisconsin. And you know, that was really the genesis of why I decided to run.
All right. With that, let's take our first caller. We've got Tim in Mondovi calling. Interesting question. Tim, you're on the air. Thanks for calling in.
Good morning. I'm wondering with the guests what their stance are on legalization of marijuana. The reason I ask that is with Colorado changing their law, I figure Wisconsin is probably going to be within the next 10 years. And if incumbents keep their seats, you know, if either one of these people win, they're probably going to have their seat for the next 10 years. So one of these people will probably have to vote on whether or not we make marijuana legal.
All right. Great question. Thanks so much, Tim. Christina, let's start with you.
Well, I can tell you this. I have supported and was a co-sponsor of the Jackie Rickert medical marijuana bill, a constituent of mine who actually lives in Mondovi, who's been struggling with a serious degenerative neuromuscular disease for a long time. And marijuana was one of the things that could alleviate a lot of her suffering. And after having met with her, I got on board with co-sponsoring medical marijuana bills every time I've been in session. Now, I can tell you, full legalization is something I'm of the opinion that we can have an opportunity to sit back and see how things play out in Colorado and Washington State and really see how things work. And that's the upside of this whole thing is there's two states that are essentially conducting an experiment for us, and we can see how the results play out in those two states over the next few years and really go from there. I have not, you know, like I said, I have not really made up my mind on full legalization. As a former police officer, I have real concerns about drug use and addiction, and I've dealt with a lot of people that have problems. But by the same token, I can tell you, I would have much rather dealt with somebody who was high on marijuana than somebody who was intoxicated on alcohol. Mm. It tended to be easier to deal with and those sorts of things. But I think as far as full legalization for everything, I think we can afford to sit back and wait and see what happens.
Isaac Wicks, your thoughts on marijuana legalization either for medical purposes or recreation?
Well, there's one thing that people don't stop and seem to realize. The state of Wisconsin can make this as legal as they want, and it's still illegal. Marijuana is illegal at the federal level. The people who are currently, you know, distributing, using, selling, you know, manufacturing, growing marijuana in Colorado and in Washington are breaking the law. And all it'll take is the whim of the Attorney General of the United States to prosecute them. Mm-hmm. And if we, you know, follow their suit in any way, all it'll take is a political whim of the Attorney General to start prosecuting people here in Wisconsin. This is ultimately a federal thing. I would not make it legal in any way as long as it's illegal federally. Because we're opening ourselves up or we're exposing our citizens to prosecution by the federal government if we do that. Think it won't happen? Well, all it'll take is a change in Attorney General, or possibly this one will, you know, use his, quote, prosecutorial discretion to decide to go after political enemies. I mean, I can see that playing out also. So I wouldn't do it primarily, you know, well, number one, for that reason. Number two, I've spent a lot of time in the military doing drug interdiction and things like that, and the notion that marijuana is somehow harmless and better than alcohol or all this other stuff is complete nonsense. Just wait. It's going to play out. You're going to find how bad this stuff really is. I wouldn't legalize it, and I don't see any reason to. As far as the medical side is concerned, the issue there is on the federal level. If the federal decides that it's going to be used for medical purposes and it's going to be a controlled substance, just like, you know, oxycodone and everything else, that's fine. But that's going to have to start at the federal level because we're exposing people to jeopardy if we legalize it here in Wisconsin now.
Some recent news, voter ID, a lawsuit that was attempting to overturn the law that was enacted in Wisconsin back in 2011, I believe, was struck down by the 7th District Court of Appeals, a federal court. And so basically, Governor Walker, the Government Accountability Board, has sprung into action. Looks like we're going to have voter ID for this election unless anything else comes up in the courts. Do you support it, or why is or why isn't this a good idea? And Isaac, I'll start with you.
Well, what's interesting about this whole fight is if you look at voter ID and the opposition to it, the only time there was any opposition to voter ID is in swing states. If you go out east, many of the eastern seaboard states, which are predominantly blue states, have voter identification law in them, and nobody seems to complain. The reason it's a big deal here in Wisconsin is because it's a swing state, and there's, you know, thought that there's political advantage to be gained by either A, having it or not having it. The argument against it is the argument against voter identification, I think, is nonsense. It's interesting. I sat and was part of the first elections in Iraq once we went in and initially set up the democracy in Iraq. And I was in one of the poorer parts of that country. People were, you know, people there basically were, you know, farmers and you know, it was a pretty rural place. And one of the requirements to make sure that election, you know, passed the international requirements for a free and fair election was voter identification and presenting photo identification at the polling sites. So if the international community can demand that, you know, to have a quote unquote free and fair election in Iraq, I don't see why we can't do it here in the United States. In fact, the way that our elections are set up here in the United States, even the standards that Jimmy Carter puts forth for you know, the international elections, it wouldn't pass muster. So, I mean, we're still far behind the rest of the world when it comes to free and fair elections, if you will, or elections that are above board. Whether or not there's fraud, that's irrelevant. And there is fraud in our elections. What matters is there a perception of it? And any time that you can reduce the perception that fraud is taking place, it's better for the elections.
Chris Dano, your thoughts on the appeals court decision and also what it means for this upcoming election?
Well, you know, I didn't support it. I would say I strongly disagree with my opponent's interpretation of this. If you look at what Judge Edelman said, there are probably 200,000 to 300,000 people in Wisconsin who don't have driver's licenses and don't have an ID. Now, I can speak from personal experience from a woman that I've helped get to church and also to the polling places over the years. She's 90-some years old. She hasn't driven in about 20 years. She doesn't have a driver's license or an ID card. Now, in order for her to get her ID, she's going to have to figure out a way to get up to Whitehall, or down, which is the only DMV office we have in Wisconsin, in Trumbull County, on either a Tuesday or a Thursday, and then go up there, somehow gain access to her birth certificate, and then go up there and get an ID in order for her to vote at the same polling place she's been voting at for probably the past 50 years. Now, that should instruct people as to what this really means. And I will be blunt. It really is an attempt to suppress turnout among groups that Republicans view as not likely to be supportive of their policies and of them in elections. Younger people, people who tend to be transient, less people with lower income, people who live in cities who don't have cars and have never had a need for a driver's license, who rely on public transit to get back and forth. Now, imagine if you're a low-income person somewhere You have worked in a couple, three jobs. Now you will be required to somehow find a time off on probably without a lot of income and a lot of ability to afford a day off to get your way down to the DOT office to, and come up with the necessary credentials to get an ID to vote. That's putting a substantial burden in front of people's ability to vote, and that's what it's about. I understand that, but you know, we should be looking at trying to make it easier for people to vote in Wisconsin, not making it more difficult. And the fact is, when there have been investigations done, there's been no serious there's been no serious findings of in-person voter fraud, whereas a person claiming to be somebody else voting in their name or using fake names. There's just been no data to prove that and no evidence. If you're gonna try and rig the vote, you rig the vote by getting at the ballot boxes and switching ballots and things like that. So that's the only way you can do it effectively. You would require a massive conspiracy at a tremendous scale to move literally hundreds of thousands of people in order to swing elections, or even tens of thousands. Imagine what it would require for an in-person voter fraud in order to commit some sort of switch at the ballot box. It's on the face of it, it's just sort of, unfortunately, right-wing paranoia.
Chris Daniel, could I follow up, though? Governor Walker, a press release went out, I don't know, I think it was last week or the week before, saying that there's a new process at the DMV that they're going to be implementing, which would basically, you go in there and it's up to the DMV to get a hold of the Office of Vital Records, and somehow they'll work to produce all that stuff. And
yeah.
Us to
okay.
The person.
Yeah, if you buy that one, I got a bridge in Brooklyn to sell you. You know, that's the thing. I mean, you're looking at having DMV officials yet be burdened with one more thing that they have to do without providing them adequate staff. I suspect you're going to have long lines. It's going to slow a lot of things down. Again, it's just what it does is the idea is not. It's just to make it more difficult for people, particularly low-income people, elderly people, younger, more transient people to vote. That's all it's about.
We've got a caller on the line. This is Willem in Colfax. Willem, you're on the air. Thanks for calling in. You got some thoughts on voter ID?
Yes. This comparison to the United States and Iraq. The United States is a very old democracy, one of the older democracies in the world, and Iraq was just coming off a brutal dictatorship. And you know, to make any kind of comparison between voting in the United States of America and voting in Iraq, I think is patently absurd. And the other thing is, my wife has worked as a poll worker in our township for 20 years, and people think that you can't just walk in and vote. You have to show your residency, some mail, a bill. There are many things that you have to do in order to register to vote. It's not like you can just walk in and say, "Oh, hi, I live here. I want to vote." It's not like that. And this new ruling is going to cost the state millions of dollars because my wife and all the other workers, poll workers, now have to be trained, and they get paid for that training, and that training is paid for by the citizens of Wisconsin. So this is, the federal judge said there was no evidence of this, so this is, a crime that doesn't exist, and this doesn't even solve any problem of, like the other gentleman said about voter fraud. It would take a lot more than a few people claiming to be someone else. And in a democracy, the object is to get as many people to vote as possible and make it easy to vote, and Wisconsin has always led the nation in that, and I personally have been very proud of that effort, and this is, you know, it's a political ploy. It's plain and simple.
All right. Willem, thanks so much for the call. We've got the candidates running for the 92nd State Assembly District. They are in Democratic incumbent Chris Dano and Republican challenger Isaac Wicks. Isaac, any response to Willem?
You know, once again, this notion it's a political ploy. I've pulled up the map of all the states with voter identification law, and we've got, you know, vast right-wing conspiracy bastions like Massachusetts and Rhode Island and Delaware and Pennsylvania and Virginia. So I tell you what, here's another one, Michigan. So the notion that this is some big vast right-wing conspiracy to get people to prove who they are, you know, is nonsense. And it's fact that, yeah, we can't compare the United States to Iraq. You know, we've got a backwater third-world country that can manage to get everybody with voter identification, but we can't have, you know, the premier country in the world, the richest country in the world, can't get voter identification. That's complete nonsense. We've already offered this for free for everybody. And I tell you what, if you can't go to the polls or you can't, you know, get your voter identification, give me a call. I'll help you do it. this notion, when they actually were suing against this, they had to manufacture people who supposedly couldn't get out and vote. I mean, it's always a hypothetical of somebody who can't vote. It's never any actual individual. So it's nonsense. It's complete nonsense. This thing has been upheld by the Supreme Court at least once. It occurs in other states. Most of the states in the country have some sort of voter identification. We're just putting ourselves in with the rest of the country. That's all we're doing. It's not a right-wing conspiracy. Turns out everybody's doing it.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, an election forum with candidates in Western Wisconsin's 92nd State Assembly District. Incumbent Chris Dano, a Democrat from Trempealeau, and his Republican challenger, Isaac Wicks of Elmwood. The district includes all or parts of Trempealeau, Jackson, and Buffalo counties. The forum was recorded earlier this week at WPR's Eau Claire Studios. The moderator is Rich Kramer.
Another thing that's been in the news recently, gentlemen, is the word of a structural deficit. It's really hard for, I think, the everyman to wrap their heads around this. But according to the state's nonpartisan fiscal bureau, Wisconsin is projected to end the current biennial budget with a nearly $400 million deficit. As for the next biennial budget, it's predicted that's 2015 through 2017. It's projected that there will be a $1.8 billion structural deficit. So does this warrant any kind of a budget repair bill in the near future or in the near term? And looking on more long term, how should the projected $1.8 billion deficit be addressed? Chris Dano, I'll start with you.
Well, you know, it's funny. I actually spoke to this on the floor of the assembly when we were debating several of the bills that created this structural deficit. It was, you know, there were these projections of a surplus because the economic forecasts were overly rosy. So being a political year, the folks on the other side of the aisle and the governor decided they wanted to run out and be able to say they cut taxes. And that's really what's led to this. This is a classic example of political posturing and wanting to do a tax cut, creating the problem we're in. And, you know, that's what it boils down to. I got up on the floor of the assembly. I said that to my colleagues on the other side. I said, look, this is not – you're taking a surplus that we don't have, and you're going to go ahead and do this tax cut, and we'll see what happens. And unfortunately, I don't like to be right in these sorts of circumstances, but I was. And what it boils down to is you're much better dealing off with a circumstance where you actually have the surplus in your hands, and then you decide what to do with it instead of cutting and doing all sorts of things like that before you have it. You know, that I don't know of any business that does that. I don't know of any household that typically does that, where you have a projection, and then you go ahead and run out and spend the money before you actually have it. But being a political year, you've got a posture. Now, what concerns me, and this is where there's a sort of a brilliance in what the Republicans do with this sort of stuff. They cut, 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 and then we have another deficit. And then we've got to go out and hammer some more on the good, decent services that people need, like our rural schools, our infrastructure, all those sorts of things, and then scream poverty after basically you did it to yourselves. And that's really what I find so frustrating. And I think this is a classic example of what's happened. So I think we'll have to see as we move forward what I'm hoping those projections are overly negative or overly conservative. But if they aren't, we are going to have to deal with it. There's no doubt about it. You have to balance the state budget.
Budget repair bill in the
in the near future,
January?
I don't expect this legislature to go back into session unless it were to be after the election and a special lame duck session were to be called. But who knows? I could see it's very possible a repair bill could be introduced sometime in January or February, but I wouldn't expect anything before that.
Isaac Wicks, what do you make of this, the projected budget structural deficit of $1.8 billion, also the near-term $400 million supposedly in this current budget that we are facing right now? And what would you do to remedy it?
Well, right now the budget as it is, you know, they project at the beginning of the year what they're going to end, you know, what the money coming in and the money going out is going to be, and they were off this time by like 1.6% or something like that. So, you know, if you could budget that close, you know, that's pretty good. The thing is, we got another quarter to the rest of the year. I mean, when these original budgets were, when it was originally projected, we didn't have the downturn that happened in the first quarter of this year. I mean, the entire country there was loss. And the thing is whenever there's You're looking at, you know, the income coming into the state is income or sales taxes and things like that. And if sales drop off like they did at the beginning of the year, you're gonna have less money coming in. So it's a matter of projecting. And is this good, bad, or indifferent? It just means that either A, we're not good at projecting or something. So, anyways, as far as a structural deficit, here's, you know, that word is thrown around quite a bit, but a lot of people don't quite understand what it means. And if I can explain it, and the big structural deficit problem that we're going to have is the Department of Transportation is where the big structural deficit is actually going to occur. Mm-hmm. And it's due to the way that it's funded. Now, the people out there need to understand that when the government is funded, it isn't one great big pot that everything goes in, everything comes out of that one great big pot. There's different, you know, sections or whatever that the money goes into. And keep in mind, like, let's use transportation to begin to for an example here. You know, the transportation is funded with, you know, the taxes on gasoline and fees for your car and things like that, and generally nothing from the general budget is used for that, and nothing from like the school's budget or anything like that. You know, they don't cross the lines unless there's some sort of legislative action pulling that money across those lines. Well, if you take like the transportation budget, when you have it's funded by a gasoline tax of a set amount per gallon, like there's a set cents per gallon it's funding. Well, over time, that 29 cents or 39 cents, whatever it is, over time, that the value of that money goes down and the cost of repairing the roads goes up. So you're still only collecting that 29 cents per gallon, but, you know, the cost of gasoline is going up, the cost of doing roads is going up, and everything else. Well, what that does is it creates a divergence in the funding apparatus to the spending apparatus. So what's going to happen is a lot of these funding apparatuses that have, you know, set amounts are going to have to change they're going to have to be tied to the time value of money in order for them to reflect, you know, truly what's going on with a lot of this stuff. So it's something that needs to be worked out. As far as the budget deficit, I mean, here we're sitting at, you know, a few million dollars. It certainly isn't the $3 billion it was when Walker took over, you know, 4 years ago. That was completely, you know, it caused a lot of heartache to get that thing straightened out. So to get a couple million dollars straightened out, that's not going to take a whole lot. And, you know, all it'll take is, you know, the end of the year here, a good economic quarter, and it'll, you know, we can go back into surplus again. So the amount we have here is within the margin of error, if you will, and I don't see it as being a big problem, and it's not going to take a budget repair bill to fix it like it did when we have a $3 billion deficit.
I'd like to stick to the transportation budget stuff that you brought up, Isaac, and I'll stay with you. You've got some counties, well, Chippewa County, for example, which is outside of the district for the 92nd, but they just passed a $10 wheel tax. City of Appleton passed a $20 wheel tax. That's on top of the state fees for registration. Is that an option for local governments who might be feeling the pinch?
Well, it definitely is an option for them. But
do you approve
of it? It's something, you know, that you know, it's going to cause hate and discontent, like it always does when you raise taxes. The problem is when you have. And this goes to what I was describing with the funding. When you have, if we just decided, or if a county decides, okay, we're going to have a set wheel tax, and we're going to say, okay, $10 per wheel or whatever it is they're going to set, as soon as you have the funding mechanism as a set dollar amount, every day going forward, the actual value of that decreases due to the time value of money. So eventually it's going to have to be revisited, and that's what's happening with the transportation fund right now is the way that taxes are collected for the transportation fund has to be revisited periodically, and, you know, tax increases are, you know, have to be, you know, instituted, if you will, to make up for that budget deficit due to the lack of, you know, lack of tying the mechanism to the time value of money.
And, Chris Dano, you were in the legislature when there was a committee or a special commission that was a special committee was commissioned, I guess, a group of people came up with ideas and suggestions for state lawmakers and the governor as far as the budget deficit. They suggest that we got to raise $600 million. Some of the things that they suggested, 5-cent increase on the state's gas tax, the new mileage-based registration fees, everything from toll roads, also, eliminate sales tax exemption for trade-in of vehicles. A whole number of solutions were offered, but lawmakers didn't take any of them.
Well, yeah, the whole, again, this is the first, I can tell you, the one, I went to Madison to try and do good policy, and the frustrating thing when you do this is we had a good committee that crafted a good set of policy alternatives that we should have discussed and debated. But again, because of politics and the refusal of anybody on the other side of the aisle to even countenance something like some sort of revenue increase, the whole thing was shelved. So this is where people need to realize, and I have these frank discussions with my constituents. Look, you're going to pay one way or another if we don't do these needed infrastructure projects. A good example was part of the reason we're in this hole, not the entire, but part of it is because back in 2000, I believe it was in 2006, the state eliminated gas tax indexing. Well, all that did, and that's probably cost us anywhere between, since that time, $600 to $1 billion in potential revenue that would have gone to our road system. And that was done for purely partisan reasons when gas taxes were, or purely political and posturing reasons when gas prices were high. Well, we're paying the price now in delayed maintenance and all that sort of thing. So, I encourage people to, and it's a frustrating thing about this job. Sometimes good policy is not good politics. It's always easy to say, I'm for cutting and all this. But when you don't maintain your roads, it costs you in the long run. It costs more to replace them and repair them as you go on. It costs more in routine vehicle maintenance for people who are operating their cars on roads that are not up to standard. A good example, we've lost two windshields to rocks. What's a $250 windshield goes a long way towards offsetting whatever supposed tax cut you got. Yeah. So those are the kind of things we really need to think about is what are we willing to, what do we want, and what are we willing, how are we willing to pay for it? So, and you've got to have honest discussions. And unfortunately, right now, the tone in Madison is to not have honest discussions on a lot of these things, and partly because the governor's running, wants to run for president. So if he does anything that would increase taxes, he knows that would be a killer in the Republican primaries.
So would
so
you?
That's where we're at. We're sitting with a lot of this kind of stuff right now, unfortunately.
I mean, without going step by step through what the committee suggested, would you raise the gas tax, for example?
Well, I think we should probably look at getting indexing back at least, because then you at least have an escalator to go up along with cost of living. The thing you got to think about when we got rid of gas tax indexing, the beauty of a fuel tax is everybody that's filling up their tank in Wisconsin is helping maintain the roads. That means if you're traveling here from Minnesota, Illinois, Iowa, any other state, you're helping to maintain the roads. When we got rid of those types of indexing, we have to go into the general fund to help with road maintenance. And that means the only people that are paying out of the general fund are Wisconsin residents. So really what's happened is other people from other states are getting a better deal, and some they're paying less, so Wisconsin residents can pay more, all because of political posturing. And that's the kind of thing we need to stop doing.
Isaac Wicks, as far as the gas tax, would you vote to either bring back indexing or raise it, the 5 cents that this committee says, 5 cents, that's all you need, it'll fix it for the time being?
Once again, like I said, raising anything by a set amount is not going to solve the problem in the long term.
How about indexing?
The indexing, the funding, interestingly enough, indexing was taken out during a Democrat administration. So apparently this is bipartisan, unlike just the evil Republicans doing things. So anyway, it's probably something that needs to be looked at, and as far as registration for cars, I mean, you've got a lot of these cars that are, that people are getting tax rebates to get that are high mileage cars. Well, it turns out they drive on roads just as much as the rest of us do. So, I can see a lot of these, people who are getting cars for vanity reasons that they can pay $80,000-$90,000 for an electric car that they probably should end up paying a little bit more for the registration because they're driving on the same roads we are. So there's that too. But once again, like I said, ultimately this has to be tied to the time value of money, and that's where the indexing thing, is one of the things that comes in. They're saying 5 cents a gallon. Once again, it's something that's going to have to be looked at. I mean, we're not building any new roads per se in Wisconsin. Everything is just being maintained at this point. So it's a fairly, predictable cycle what we're doing. So, we can, talk to the the transportation secretary and see just exactly the projections of what it needs to have and how to fund it. So that keeping that in mind, we're going to have to look and see what the to what level we're going to do stuff. I mean, you take a look at Minnesota, and a lot of their township roads aren't even paved. Well, here in Wisconsin, we pave nearly everything. So the question is, you know, are we going to pay for paving township roads and things like that that you know, a lot of the other states in the neighborhood don't do? So, we're going to have to look at the whole picture. You know, we can't just keep raising the cost or raising the amount of taxes we're collecting from people without taking a look and seeing, you know, what's the true value added of this.
You're listening to a Candidates Forum for Wisconsin's 92nd State Assembly District on Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCollum. The forum was recorded earlier this week in our Wisconsin Public Radio studios in Eau Claire. The moderator is WPR's Rich Kramer. The candidates are incumbent Democratic State Representative Chris Dano of Trempealeau, who is seeking a fourth two-year term in the legislature. His challenger is Republican Isaac Wicks of Elmwood, a businessman and military veteran who has sought office in several legislative races in the past and is a Democrat in the recall election of 2012 for Wisconsin Lieutenant Governor. Voters will cast their ballots in the November 4th general election. The candidate with the most votes will represent all or parts of Buffalo, Trempealeau, and Jackson counties in the state assembly for the next 2 years. More from this forum in just a moment. Coming up, frac sand mining. It's been a major issue for several years in the district, and the candidate's views on the issue are very different. To your audio archives of today's show, visit our website, wpr.org/newsmakers. You'll also find links to the candidates' websites, as well as archives of other recent editions of Newsmakers. And if you'd like to share your comments or make a suggestion for a future show, you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. We're in the middle of an election forum with candidates in western Wisconsin's 92nd State Assembly District. The district includes all or parts of Trempealeau, Jackson, and Buffalo counties, and includes the communities of Trempealeau, Galesville, Arcadia, and Black River Falls. Frac sand mining has been a huge issue for many of the district's communities, and the candidates could not have more different views on the issue. We're about to find that out as incumbent Democrat Chris Dano of Trempealeau and his GOP challenger Isaac Wicks conclude this forum. Dano has served the past 3 terms in the state assembly and is a former police officer in Onalaska. Wicks is a business owner and a military veteran who has run for office before, 3 times for the state legislature, and most recently in the statewide recall for lieutenant governor, where he ran as a protest Democrat. Wisconsin Public Radio's Rich Kramer moderated the forum, recorded earlier this week at the Wisconsin Public Radio studios in Eau Claire.
In the last 2 sessions, there were bills introduced by Republican lawmakers that would have scaled back what aspects of frac sand mining could be regulated by local governments. The main argument was that some local officials are hostile to mining and they're creating a patchwork of ordinances that makes it hard to navigate and effectively keeps companies out. So should local town and county officials have free rein over how they regulate frac sand mining? Isaac Wicks.
Once again, this always goes down to whether or not you're for it or against it, to which level. You know, the problem that we have is down in, Buffalo and Trempealeau counties. The fact that you've got townships that want to have it come in, the county doesn't want to have it come in, the city will want it to come in, the city will annex the township, the county will sandbag it as long as they can, they'll go through a bunch of lawsuits, it'll end up going in. You know, it's one of these things where it is creating a problem there. The thing is the way that it's frac sand mining will continue to grow, but here in Buffalo, Trempealeau, and Jackson counties, it's kind of reached the. It's probably gotten as much as it's going to be. Ultimately, the limiting factor on the frac sands in those 3 counties is going to be the transportation to get it out. And right now, they've just about reached the capacity of the railway to get it out of there. So you're probably not going to see a whole lot more frac sand mines going in. So ultimately, the ones that are in there are in there. They're changing the rules at this point for that, for this is probably not going to bring more in or keep more out or whatever it is you're planning on doing with it. So I don't see a whole lot of legislative push to change anything at this point in time. We'll see how things work out in the courts as far as, some of these townships and cities suing one another as far as getting the getting these things in. But right now the locals are it's going through the local channels at this point. Would it have been easier? This would have been easier if this stuff would have been figured out, 15 years ago. But unfortunately, that's not going to happen. And like I said, we're probably reached the end of the number of sand mines that are going to end up going in anyway. So any law right now probably isn't going to make a whole lot of difference.
All right, Chris Dano, should the local officials, town and county officials, have free rein over how they regulate frac sand mining, including regulatory things like environmental stuff, the DNR?
Let me just, one of the finest moments I think I had in the legislature last session was beating back that bill that took away local control. Senator Vineout and myself fought long and hard against that, and we're very proud of the fact that we're able to. Sometimes it's not only what you pass, it's what you defeat, and we're very proud of defeating that bill. Very, very proud. I can't think of any of my constituents, even the ones that, most of them who wanted something like that. And Mr. Wicks's cavalier attitude towards the whole issue speaks to the fact that he doesn't really live here. Because if you lived here, you'd know that this is a big issue. You'd also know that sand mining is going to continue to be an issue and that there are continuing permitting applications going forward for sand mines, and there's no sign of it stopping. I guess if you'd lived in the district, you'd actually know that, Isaac. But the point being is we need local officials, the people who are most directly in touch with their constituents, the people who have to live there, the people who are most impacted by these things, to have the ability to make sure they can protect the health and safety of the constituents and the people they represent. And I will always be supportive of making sure that local officials have the tools to do that. That being said, I do think we need to make sure that the state is adequately monitoring these facilities. You're seeing continuing news reports of pollution, of discharges, of creeks. I think there's just one up by Chippewa Falls, that was just in the news. We had several violations here in Trempealeau County, and some of them, quite frankly, can be dangerous. If some of these berms and mine pits and some of these berms that hold back water give way, they can flood neighbors. We've had sand, essentially small, for lack of a better term, flood events going into people's homes and ruining their homes. So this is real. It's having a real impact on the people that live around them, and I think it's something that we need to address. And it's not going to be addressed by state officials taking away the ability of local officials to have their ability to protect the health and safety of their constituents.
What about, one of the things that those bills included was the argument that, well, local officials are trying to enact, environmental regulations that above and beyond what the DNR does.
Well,
should they be able to do that?
Keep in mind, the state law allows local officials to do things to protect the health and safety, to enact ordinances to protect the health and safety of their constituents. Good reason why you don't necessarily want that is the topography around here is very, very different than it is, say, in the more flat parts of the state where, say, Mr. Wicks actually lives.
Like Elmwood? You probably haven't been here, have you?
One at a time, gentlemen.
One of those things where, you have to allow local officials to take into local consideration the effect.
I'm sorry, Isaac. One at a time.
Are just horrific for the district.
I had you muted, so we didn't hear what you said. One at a time, please. Go ahead, Isaac.
All right. To keep in mind, I know that Chris likes to bring up this fact. Oh, you're not from the district. You're not from the district. Apparently, I live in the flat, hills of Elmwood or something. But anyways, I grew up less than 2 miles from an open pit mine, and I didn't die. The other things that these sand mines are creating is jobs, and they're creating very good jobs. Jobs where you can be a kid, know how to drive a tractor, and come down there and make $30 an hour jobs. The one of the things that people seem to forget is one of the reasons that I went to Iraq in the first place was to protect the world's oil supply. We have the opportunity to become energy independent here in the United States. And one of those things that we have here is sand from western Wisconsin. It's part of the solution to doing that. So I tell you what, the mitigation that we're going to have to do of the minor problems there is with a few more trucks in the road is insignificant compared to what we have to do by going to war to keep the oil supply going. So I tell you what, it's the net gain that we're getting out of the sand mines that we have here far outweighs any of the negative that we're ever going to endure.
And I'll stay with you, Isaac. Some people, in fact, a lot of people that live around these mines are concerned about the dust, and they want the DNR to study the really fine dust, not just the normal dust blowing off of piles. The DNR has said our standards are good enough. Do you think another look should be taken at what they call...
Well, the whole thing with that is a lot of that is nonsense. It's brought up. Farming creates far more dust than those sand mines have. Farming uses far more water than the sand mines do. Farming tears up far more ground than the sand mines do. So a lot of the fight against this is a red herring. And, you know, people are using this to create animosity among neighbors. When you know a lot of the issues are projected, perceived problems, and like I said, there are certain issues you are going to have problems with roads, things like that. But once again, the cost of rebuilding roads is far cheaper than the cost of putting an army together and going over to Iraq.
Gotcha, Chris Dano. Thoughts about should the DNR take a look at the ultra fine?
I think so. I mean, again, you know, one of the things you got to remember is our non-metallic mining laws were drawn up a long time ago, and they really weren't meant to address these large-scale, really heavy industrial sand mining operations. They're really generally aimed at the smaller quarrying, you know, the traditional smaller, 10, 20 acre sand pits that really, you know, usually didn't take up more than, 20, 30, 40 acres and then were closed up and moved on. You have operations now that are hundreds, if not thousands of acres in size and, having a much, much more significant impact on a local neighborhood than just a little sand pit that Mr. Wicks referred to. Very, very different circumstances, very different situations. You have huge, huge piles of sand sitting out in the open, allowing the wind to blow on them. And I can tell you, people have talked to me about the real concerns they have of sand blowing into the driveway. We had particulate matter, some of the sand grains, particulate matter were found in the air cleaning system of one of my local schools. I believe it was the Cochran Fountain City School District discovered fine silica dust in their air handling system, which was a real concern. I can tell you the people whose kids go to school, that's a real concern to the people that live there, whether or not you support sand mining or not. I'm not saying I'm against it, but again, we need to make sure that it's done right and done correctly. And to just sort of cavalierly wave away the real concerns that people have about this, again, unfortunately speaks to whether you're really interested in representing the people of the district or if you've just got an ideological axe to grind.
Well, once ideological axe to grind, once again, this is one of those things where actually going out and being out in the world and seeing things other, from a different perspective. If silica sand dust killed people, everybody in the Middle East would be dead, along with people in southwestern United States. So this notion that it's somehow, the silica dust in the air is causing cancer is a red herring that's thrown out by the environmental left to try to stop this stuff. Cut and dry, that's all it is. There's no real proof of it whatsoever. It's something that's being thrown out there because there's certain people that just don't want this to go forward.
Well, let me say this. The EPA regulates it and considers it a carcinogen now in the workplace. So clearly they have concerns. You have to have, again, this is one of those examples. We are dealing with something that has never really been done at this scale before in this area. There's nothing wrong with requiring some good studies to go out there and determine what's going on and do some monitoring to figure out if it was just studies that were going on, that would be fine.
But unfortunately, people have already made the determination at this point before these studies are concluded. That's the problem.
Sure. Okay.
Candidates in the November 4th general election for the seat in Wisconsin's 92nd State Assembly District. We heard from incumbent Democrat Chris Dano of Trempealeau and his challenger, Elmwood Republican Isaac Wicks. Dano is a former Onalaska police officer and has served in the Assembly since first winning election in the fall of 2008. Wicks is a business owner and military veteran who has previously been a candidate for four other legislative and state offices. The two participated in a broadcast forum recorded earlier this week in Wisconsin Public Radio's Eau Claire studios, moderated by WPR reporter Rich Kramer. Thanks for listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Our production team includes John Gatto, Mary Mian Strube, and our senior news editor and producer, John Davis. If you missed part of today's show, you can find the audio archives at WPR.org/newsmakers. You'll also find links to the candidates' websites and Wisconsin Vote. Our site also has archives of other recent editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make a suggestion for a future show, you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more at WPR.org/newsmakers. For updates on future shows, links to our archives and more, like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers.